Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuheeb. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight:
a man who hijacked an Egyptian passenger jet and forced it to land in Cyprus has been arrested, and Cypriot authorities say all passengers and crew are safe. After hours of tense negotiations, the flight was heading from Alexandria to the Egyptian capital when it was hijacked.
That's Edward Yerenyen reporting from Cairo. Details coming up.
Also, a human rights group says in Nigeria, the Chibok abductions by Boko Haram were not the only large-scale kidnappings by the group that year. And the UN Refugee Agency reports hunger as well as ongoing conflict are driving tens of thousands of South Sudanese to flee their country.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour: a man who hijacked an Egyptian passenger jet and forced it to land in Cyprus has been arrested. Cypriot authorities say all passengers and crew are safe after hours of tense negotiations. As Edward Uranian reports from Cairo, the flight was heading from Alexandria to the Egyptian capital when it was hijacked.
The final captives on board the hijacked Egypt airplane were seen exiting the aircraft on the tarmac of Larnaca Airport after a tense standoff inside the plane. Cypriot authorities insist terrorism is not the cause of the Tuesday incident, despite initial reports the hijacker was wearing an explosive belt and had threatened to blow up the plane. Cypriot media reported the hijacker, identified as Seyfeddin Mustafa, wanted to speak to his former wife, who lives in Cyprus. Arab media claimed the man was demanding prisoners in Egypt be released, but Egyptian officials denied the report. Before the hijacker was arrested, Egypt's civil aviation minister, Sharif Fathi, said the exact level of the threat was not clear.
We are not sure whether what he has is a true bomb or threat to the aircraft, but we are dealing with it as a real threat because we cannot take any risk.
But he said security on the plane was good and the hijacker had not been able to enter the cockpit, preventing a more serious threat. Egyptian TV also showed video of the man going through a metal detector at Alexandria Airport before boarding. Cypriot President Nikos Anastasiadis told local media a domestic issue was behind the hijacking. The hijacker's former wife, a Cypriot, was brought by local police to the airport to meet with him. Another Egypt Air flight from Cairo to New York was delayed due to a potential security threat. Egypt's aviation minister told journalists the flight was delayed both for security reasons and because passengers from the hijacked flight were due to board the plane. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Some parents of Nigerian schoolgirls kidnapped from Chibok nearly 2 years ago say they are still waiting to go to Cameroon. They want to confirm whether a girl who claims to be one of those abducted really is from Chibok. Doubts have arisen about her identity. The Associated Press reports Cameroon officials say the child, who was arrested Friday with explosives strapped to her chest, is about 10 years old. The Chibok parents say the government has promised to send them to Cameroon to identify the girl. Some 219 girls taken by Boko Haram on April 15, 2014, remain missing.
The kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls from the northern Nigerian town of Chibok garnered worldwide attention, and it still does. But a human rights group says the Chibok abductions by Boko Haram were not the only large-scale kidnappings by the group that year. Human Rights Watch says much less attention has been paid to the 400 women and children abducted from the town of Damasak in November 2014. The trading town is located about 200 kilometers northwest of Maiduguri, near the border with Niger. HRW researcher Mousi Shegun says the Nigerian government has not talked about the Damasak incident and says it's not clear whether it's taken any action. From Abuja, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about the abductions.
According to the witnesses that we interviewed, it was in the morning of November 24th when gunmen, apparently, who presented themselves and introduced themselves to the residents of Damasak, as Boko Haram members. The insurgents closed all the roads into the town where they began to rob traders, kill those who resisted, and even those who didn't resist. And then they moved into the primary school. At that time, there were about 300 students in the school. Their ages ranged between 7 years and 17 years. Some of the teachers were able to escape with some of the children, but the insurgents also went back into the town and arrested more women and children, bringing them back into the school, which had not turned into a camp. They were held in this school for, I think, about 4 months until March 2015. In all, it is estimated that there were about 500 or more people in that school during that period, some of whom died of some kind of food poisoning. Others were also deliberately killed by the insurgents for all kinds of infections. It seems likely that there were up to 400 women and children taken away by the insurgents.
Now, do we know anything about those who were taken away? Have we heard about the fate of any of them?
Well, not formally, but some of the relatives told us in Maiduguri that they had information from other refugees who were in Chad that they had sighted some of those children and women with Boko Haram insurgents around the border areas with Nigeria. And we haven't been able to verify that, but we've put this information out there and to the Nigerian government in the hopes that there might be efforts to check out that information and efforts to also rescue the children if possible.
As you know, there has been a military offensive involving Nigeria and its neighbors against Boko Haram. Do you know whether during those military actions any evidence of the kidnapped women and children from Damasak was found?
Not at all. According to the relatives of the missing people, they have made efforts to investigate and to check the identities of those who have been rescued, and they have not found not even one of the missing people from Damasak among those rescued hostages.
Human Rights Watch says it's unclear whether the Nigerian government has made any serious effort to secure their release. Has HRW contacted the government?
We have written to them about our findings, but we haven't received any response from the government yet, so we're waiting for that. We're not aware of any steps that the government has taken, and we're hoping that they will inform us, and especially the families, about any steps taken.
Mousi Shegun is a researcher for Human Rights Watch from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
The UN Refugee Agency reports hunger as well as ongoing conflicts are driving tens of thousands of South Sudanese to flee their war-torn country into Sudan in search of food and security. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The United Nations reports 2.3 million people in South Sudan have been forced to flee their homes since civil war erupted in December 2013. Nearly 750,000 of these people have gone to neighboring countries as refugees. While conflict and violence have been driving the forced displacement, a new element behind recent flight has emerged. The UN Refugee Agency reports a serious shortage of food caused by the ongoing conflict and deteriorating economic conditions is prompting an increasing number of people to head to neighboring Sudan. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says the situation is particularly bad in the northwestern states of northern Bahr al-Ghazal and Warab. He says some 38,000 people have fled into the East Darfur and South Darfur regions of Sudan over the past 2 months. He says people arriving in Sudan are in poor condition, with many having risked their lives en route. He tells VOA he fears the exodus from South Sudan will grow as the nutritional situation rapidly deteriorates.
Insecurity is a major aspect of this, but increasingly food insecurity as well is causing more people to be on the move. They're among 2.8 million people now officially classified as facing a crisis of food security in South Sudan.
Edward says people clearly are suffering the effects of being without sufficient food. He says global acute malnutrition rates have risen above the emergency threshold of 15%. He says several interagency assessment missions are underway in parts of Sudan to determine how best to meet refugee needs. He says a composite picture is emerging from preliminary assessments and that the situation is universally desperate, with many refugees having traveled for up to 4 weeks under difficult circumstances. He notes many children have been separated from their families en route, and that the newly arriving refugees are living in overcrowded conditions, with many being sick and in need of medical care. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Burundi, 7 people were reported wounded today in grenade attacks on a police bus in Bujumbura. The AFP news agency says 2 grenades were thrown at the bus, injuring 6 police officers and a child. No word on who the attackers might be. Last week, 3 people were wounded by grenades and 2 senior army officers were assassinated. The attacks followed weeks of relative calm in the capital. About 400 people have been killed since violence broke out about 1 year ago. That's when President Nkurunziza announced he would seek a 3rd term. Hundreds of thousands of Burundians have fled to neighboring countries.
Migrants and refugees clashed today with Greek police at the Macedonian border. They are among thousands of people at the overcrowded camp at Idomene. They were protesting the continued closure of the border. Authorities are spreading the word that the border will remain closed, blocking a main route to Western Europe. The Associated Press says the clash with police started when officers tried to remove migrants who were blocking railroad tracks. Some threw rocks at police. The violence ended when other migrants stepped in and separated the 2 groups. Also, despite the new deal between the European Union and Turkey to stem the flow of migrants and refugees, about 500 people arrived on the Greek island of Lesbos today. Most were from Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, and Pakistan. Under the new deal, they'll be detained and then returned to Turkey for registration. Also, Turkey is cracking down on suspected people smugglers. Authorities detained 18 people today, mostly Syrians, for allegedly trying to help people cross the Aegean Sea to Greece. The anti-smuggling operations were conducted in 5 Turkish cities.
The International Organization for Migration, IOM, says the main route for migrants traveling from North Africa to Italy is getting busy again. More migrants arrived this morning after crossing the Mediterranean, and more are anticipated tomorrow and in the months ahead. The IOM says the majority are from Nigeria and other West African countries. Today's arrivals are in addition to more than 700 people, mostly from Nigeria, who were rescued on the Mediterranean on Sunday. Joel Millman is a spokesperson for IOM in Geneva. He spoke with me about the increase in migrants traveling from North Africa to Italy and what the expectation is for the coming months.
You know that historically, so far this year, the biggest country that has been represented in these rescues has been Nigeria. Those numbers are way up over years past in terms of who's coming across from North Africa. It tends to be West Africans, Sub-Saharan mostly, but the Eritreans and Somali and Sudanese don't tend to come until after April most years. So we're expecting those numbers to change. What is notable is that so far this year, Italian authorities have only reported 6 Syrians have come across on that route. And the Syrians were running around 40,000 a year as recently as 2014. So we know that there's big numbers out there that have been using Greece. Now that that's getting harder, they may start coming through North Africa again.
And you're expecting more migrants to arrive there tomorrow?
Well, there's a group come up 7:30 that should have landed by this morning already, and then another group of 351, we're told, are coming to Port of Augusta in Italy. So that's 1,000 in a couple of days, which is a big pickup from a few weeks ago. However, historically, not a very high number for a week on the Mediterranean. We did see over Easter weekend a terrible decline in number of migrants crossing from Turkey into Greece. Don't know if that has a factor of the new migrant agreement between the EU and Turkey or Easter holiday or what, but we're talking about fewer than 300 over 2 days. So we think that we'll see that pick up, but if it doesn't, that traffic may shift back to North Africa like it did a couple of years ago.
Do you know why the increase in the migrants coming from the North Africa route?
We heard various things. One of them was a period of interfighting among the militias and the traffickers who operate that industry along the north coast between Tripoli and the Tunisian border. We had heard there was a lot of arguing about market share and who was going to do what and where they were going to do it, and the road became dangerous and there'd be spontaneous shootouts like in the movies, and so the traffic just slowed down to a crawl. We've also heard that there are different authorities trying to crack down. Crack down can also be a euphemism for demanding higher bribes. We've heard both versions of that story. But we think that underlying conditions haven't changed so much that we think the traffic's going to end. Although last year, you know, obviously the Eastern Mediterranean route far exceeded what was happening along the Libya to Italy route, what we call the Central Mediterranean route. So we're pretty much bracing ourselves for an extremely busy year in that sector starting a few weeks from now.
And I guess that is also attributed to the weather as well, because things are getting warmer, so people are going to be using this as an opportunity to try to travel.
Yeah, the conditions have improved. In the last couple of weeks, we've been hearing about more abusive traffickers, women being raped on the beach, people being beaten and forced into these crafts that they don't want to get into. It's not entirely new, but we hadn't heard it for a while. And I believe in the last 2 weeks, 10 to 15 people have been found dead in these boats. I mean, many boats, not in any one boat. But two bodies here, one body there, that adds up to a dozen or so. That's something we saw a lot of in 2014, didn't see much of last year, but apparently is making a reappearance.
Do you know if there will be any monitoring of the Mediterranean migration route?
Well, there's constant monitoring, but we're kind of at the limit of what we can get from the authorities who bring the folks in. Our team in Italy is very good about getting to the dock and reading the migrants and taking a firsthand testimony of what they've seen and hopefully encouraging them to contact their families back home or seek shelter with the authorities in Italy and not to undertake an equally dangerous journey through Europe. But that's a mixed bag because, you know, once they've crossed the Mediterranean, many of them feel that the hardest part's over. But we have had some success, particularly 120 women from Nigeria have agreed to come into IOM custody and testify against the sex traffickers. And we think the total number of victims is, of course, much higher, but it's a substantial start to have 100-plus people agree to come in and cooperate with the authorities on that.
That was Joel Millman, spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration. He spoke with me from Geneva.
Twenty-three past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The French news agency reports Pakistan authorities have detained more than 200 people and questioned thousands of others following Sunday's bombing in Lahore. The attack killed more than 70 people and injured hundreds. Punjab provincial law minister Rana Sanullah says more than 5,000 people were searched and interrogated, all but 216 were released. The Jamaat-ul-Ahrar faction of the Taliban has claimed responsibility for the attack, which authorities say targeted Christians. The minister says security for 550 churches in Punjab has been tightened.
The mayor of Brussels went public today about shortcomings of the Belgian capital security apparatus. His comments come a week after suicide bombers killed 35 at the city airport and a subway station. Reporter Esther Judah talked today with VOA's David Arnold about political challenges facing the city as residents resume daily life.
What the mayor said today is we can't simply go on living like this, in which it's part laziness, but also political refusal not to share information. We simply cannot continue with the evidence showing the loss of lives last week with terrorist attacks. Is that something needs to change in terms of the political layout of Belgium, but also in terms of the administrative layout where police have to start sharing information.
What is it specifically that anybody in government is suggesting should be the new layout for how you govern or what the political climate is?
Belgium is a fractious country with many different ethnic layouts. It's not a word we use in Western Europe very much, but it's certainly the case in Belgium. With two different parliaments and also a national government, this is divisions in between the political leadership of the country. But this trickles right down in terms of the administrative leadership of the country, where we have different communes laying out in Brussels with different police services. That's one of the biggest issues that we've had in Brussels, where each commune has the responsibility over its own specific policing. This is then made even more complicated by the fact that every commune also has its local municipality, which is responsible for certain aspects of the policing, but not others. So it's a very complex makeup of the country, which has been difficult to achieve. This is a country which didn't have a government for nearly a year.
It sounds like the mayor is not somebody that has a lot of control over what goes on.
Well, it's quite a confusing situation, I have to say, in terms of the mayor, but also in terms of the local mayors of each commune, where it's, and also something that he has said, or many of the political elite have used the word, is they have an enormous amount of power in terms of controlling their own fiefdom. But when it comes to knowing what's going on in it, in terms of the policing, this is a much more confusing situation, certainly within Brussels, where we have a Brussels police force, but then we also have these local police forces. So what information is communicated to the local mayors, and then communicated to the Brussels mayor is very much a division and a confusion even among themselves.
How does this affect the man and woman on the street?
Well, in terms of the subway, is that one of the bombings that happened on Tuesday morning actually happened in the subway. So it's much more a very practical aspect of why it's not stopping there, is that the station was quite literally blown up. And then how does it affect us on a daily basis here living in Brussels? Well, obviously it does affect us. This is something that I think the local people here are realizing. It's just we can't control what's going on. Although I have to say that Brussels is a very safe place to live. It's something that is underestimated, especially in the light of this terror, is that although we have had security threats and there is very much a security threat here in Brussels at the moment, is that it is still a very, very safe place to live in the world.
One of the expressions, I think, from the mayor, life can never return to normal.
I would say quite the opposite. This is the new normal. Life actually went back to normal very, very rapidly. In fact, even perhaps surprisingly so, is that the very day afterwards, the shops were open, businesses were open, people were back at work to normal. And that's exactly the feeling that I've had from people on the street, is that this has happened. We won't bow down to terror. And life has continued. And normal is the word that people are using in terms of how the situation is. Although that doesn't mean that there isn't a security threat, it doesn't mean that there's not anger in terms of the failures of the security services and especially the government, who've admitted responsibility. And this will have very serious consequences in terms of the next political layout of this country. And I think there will be changes, but what and how will be difficult to predict. 35 fatal victims of the attack, but only 32 have actually been identified. So perhaps the unwritten story of what's happened in Brussels is we don't know exactly who has been killed, and many are still reported missing. Story is not over for the close family of those who were affected. The number is rising, with 55 still in intensive care. This is very much a developing story in terms of how many victims this attack has actually taken.
That's reporter Esther Judah in Brussels. She spoke with VOA's David Arnold.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Audrius Regis, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.